So, as Kendrick says, I'm just a postdoc at UBC these days. What I want to tell you about is a few things. One, I want to tell you a little bit about data science and how that is coming into physics today and how that sort of fits into a little bit into the work that I do. And I want to tell you a bit about the work I do, so the cosmology side and the particularly how you're going to do that in the radio. First, just want to start with, like, I was asked to talk a little bit about data science. And so one thing I was unfamiliar with is, like, really, how is data science different to statistics? This is something I didn't have a great handle on in my head. And so I searched around on the internet a little bit. And actually, there's a reasonably succinct definition of how they're different. I wonder if data science is just statistics, but done on a Mac. So it's really just a kind of sexed up version of statistics. When I think of data science, what do I think of? So it's a combination of really the kind of classical statistics that most people think of and are familiar with, things like model fitting, model selection, you know, comparison models, the kind of stuff that really goes into science at a very high level. Things like signal processing, so processing time streams and extracting information from them in some kind of optimal way, as best you can. There's aspects of machine learning, which is the kind of, you know, fashionable stuff that people think of a lot about in data science, especially in field outside of mainstream science. You know, just things like neural nets and decision trees and things like that. These days, because we're dealing with large data sets, there's a lot of aspects of high performance computing. So, you know, both in the kind of classical, like, you have a large amount of data, you need to process it on some big cluster, you know, how do you do distributed computing? Also in the sense of, I have a large amount of data coming at me, and I need to deal with it quickly, and I need to really have, you know, high throughput computation. And there's one thing I think is important, especially in science, which is keeping a sense of the domain that the data is coming from. So really, you know, having an understanding of the physics, in our case, that controls the data. So what is the theory that's really generating your data set that you're interested in finding things out about? You know, what are the properties of the experiment that goes into it? What are the noise properties and things like that? So I think it's important to have especially have a handle on that. One thing I think that data science really isn't, despite various claims to the contrary, is the end of science as we know it. This is a sort of claim was going about a few years ago that with these huge data sets, with machine learning, we don't really need to understand what's going on anymore. We can just feed it all into some giant neural net, and that's going to give us kind of blind insights to what's going on. It's going to allow us to predict observables, and we don't really have to input any understanding into the process. I think that would be a very depressing end to science. I don't believe that's really true at all.
Explain the picture there.
I think the picture just says theory in some very fancy looking way, and there's a big cross through it. Yeah. This is just a snippet from the headline of the article. So I just want to briefly just define, like, how, you know, what kind of aspects of data science go into science itself. And so I think you can kind of divide the sort of stuff up I've talked about into, you know, the kind of classical statistical stuff is, you know, the model fitting, model selection is what we're really using in science to guide our insight. It's how we choose between theories. It's that may explain some observable phenomena. It's how we figure out parameters of those theories, like what are the masses of various particles, things like that. And the kind of more fashionable stuff, talking about the machine learning, the kind of things that give us blind insights into the problems, are extremely useful. But I think in science, they're really limited to being tools for what we want. I think if we, you know, we can use them for helping us classify various phenomena, for like reducing data down to sensible rates, for picking out interesting things. But I think it's difficult to gain any real insight from a neural net. Like, it's, you know, it's hard to feed your data into a neural net and say, okay, now I understand some physical theory. You just don't know how to do that. So, in recent years, data science has become a term which people sort of bandy around, including myself a little bit more. And so the question is, why has that become a thing? I mean, statistics has existed for a long time, so why is data science now the thing we all sort of talk about? And I think one of the big drivers of this is just the rate at which we can acquire data. So this is just a plot, you know, mainly about optical astronomy. And I think this summarizes a lot of nice things. So in optical astronomy, over the years, we've been building bigger telescopes. We've been putting bigger cameras on them. We've been, looking at larger areas of the sky because we've got bigger cameras. And so the black line is just telling you, the general sort of size of a camera on a telescope, and just in terms of the number of pixels on a CCD. And you can see, basically, over the last 40-odd years, that's grown pretty much exponentially. And so the size of these cameras and the rate at which we can acquire data has increased exponentially over that time. That's meant that in terms of the actual physical things we can look at, things like looking at galaxies, the rate at which we can survey galaxies in the sky has basically increased exponentially as well. So we're seeing an exponentially increasing amount of galaxies. And this has basically been driven by the increases in computing power and cost, or the decrease in cost over time, which is the standard kind of Moore's law argument. And that's just these points in yellow is sort of giving you a sense of that. So you can see that over 40 years we've just had this huge increase in the amount of data we can acquire at any particular time. Another flip side of that is if you think about the rate at which we're acquiring data is exponential, then the amount of data we have at any one time is also growing exponentially. You can look at different metrics of that. So this is just the data volume stored at the LHC over the last 15 years. So this is a shorter time span, and you can see that basically this has grown exponentially in that kind of time. I think there's reasons to think this is controlled actually by slightly different phenomena here. So one thing to note is for most of this time, the LHC wasn't actually turned on. So it wasn't generating any data. There's a lot of there's a lot of simulated data coming out that's being used for this, but you're not seeing any clear trend, I think, related to when the data was starting to be acquired. I think what's driving this is basically, this is the amount of data you can afford to store. So this is the amount of data that you can really afford and is realistic to store. I think it's true that in most people's experience, your ambitions for what kind of computation you are going to do and what you're going to store is driven by how much you think you can realistically get away with. If someone tells you you can have not 100 petabytes, but 1,000 petabytes, then okay, then you might not think so hard about how exactly you're going to compress down and really pick out the interesting stuff. So I think this is just really reflecting the amount of data which can be stored. So I'm just kind of putting these together. So why is data science something we talk about now? I think there's just this huge increase in the rate which we accumulate data, and corresponding the volume of data that we have in any particular experiment, and the something I haven't really talked about, but the increasing complexity of these data sets means that it's just becoming a fairly specialized job to do anything with it, in the same way that building an instrument is a specialized job, really understand the electronics. Now it's becoming that it's the amount of data is just sufficient that it's actually kind of a specialized task to really just deal with that. So just wanted to talk briefly about a few examples of where in physics recently where these kind of techniques have come in. One I think I just want to pick out is it the LHC, going back to the previous curve. So just picked, most of these numbers I'm going to talk about come from one particular detector, the LHC, LHC-B. So LHC-B is colliding protons inside it, so it looks at proton-proton collisions. There's about 4 million collisions per second. Every time a collision happens, the detector measures all sorts of properties of the collision, and to store that data would be about a megabyte in size. So it's that kind of order. So megabyte's a tiny amount, but there's a lot of that happening a second. And if you just took that at face value, the raw data rate ends up to be about a terabyte per second. And so if you just, over a year, you build up 10 exabytes a year. I mean, exabytes is just an unfathomably large amount of data. And so this is one of the smaller, in terms of data rates, experiments of the LHC. Things like Atlas and CMS are orders of magnitude above this. So it's just a huge amount of data. So what you want to be able to do is to compress this amount of data down and pick out only the interesting parts. You need to do that in real time because you can't even afford to store or process this data very quickly. So something you want to be able to do is to identify which collisions really are interesting. Now, there's several levels at which this is kind of done. At the moment, most of the detectors have hardware triggers. So they're just in, essentially there's, you know, hard programmed chips in there, or FPGAs, which are basically making decisions about which collisions are interesting based on pre-programmed criteria. And that gets the data rate down by about a factor of 30. But then you feed the data into software, which can process it at near real-time speeds. And the question is, like, given that each collision is described by some large number of parameters, how do you determine which collisions are interesting? And so you can try and carve out areas of this parameter space by hand. So you're just picking regions of this many-dimensional parameter space. But that becomes kind of tricky. It doesn't scale very well. So one way of doing this is to treat it as a kind of blind machine learning problem. So you're looking at classification as a machine learning problem. And so what you're going to do is you're going to simulate lots of different events. You're going to know which, you know, because you've simulated them, you know which ones you consider interesting, you know which ones you consider background processes that you don't really care about. You feed them into some algorithmic classification thing, and that is trained to select between the different events. And so that essentially is internally building up some idea of which regions of parameter space are interesting. In a way that is difficult for you to really, for a person to really visualize what's going on, but is an effective way of distinguishing between the two. So this kind of technique ends up being used in real time in the software triggers in things like LHCb, but was also used for actually selecting events that were used for the detection of the Higgs boson and things like CMS. So it actually is used at multiple levels in this kind of. For things like LHC.
After the fact, you discover a bug in your code, you're kind of stuck.
Right. So I mean, there's definite.
Back and reprocessing the data.
Right. So it is true that you have to make sure that the data you threw away really wasn't very interesting to you. And there's a question of, like, what are you missing in there? So I mean, I think there's a very careful process of Monte Carlo simulation through these kind of things to really see what things are you missing. Like, really, was there some interesting theoretical parameter space that you are now blind to because you threw away the collisions which would have told you about it?
If there's something completely unanticipated, you have a selected software to find it, and therefore it's gone.
Yep.
Right? It's possible to be surprised by the results that come out of these filters.
Right. I mean, that, you know, that is true. So
there are some surprises. I think it's possible.
Doesn't mean there's not. You of course can have some surprises, but you may not be aware of the things that you missed because
right.
you weren't just filtering for
it. On the other hand, this is funny too. They've been doing it for decades. They're pretty damn good at it.
I mean, I think there's an.
You also have to come to a decision if you want to throw some stuff away so you can study the rest,
sure.
Or then you're just in a morass of data that you can't analyze.
10 exabytes would fit in this room.
Mm-hmm. 10 exabytes would fit in this room if you just stacked disks, basically,
yeah.
Or you.
Right? Like, it's something trying to sell that expensive.
That's to be true. That'd be a lot of data, but yeah.
But it's not random data. This is data of fundamental physics, which we learned is surprisingly simple. It's like a standard model and extensions.
Right.
So that's a huge advantage if you compare it to, say, astronomy or
some other field where the data has much greater degree of randomness.
Right, and it's certainly true that these things are, there's very specific processes that are being trained on to find.
Right.
And so you're looking for production of particular intermediate particles, and that's, you know, and the new physics comes in the rate at which those are generated. So you're still sensitive to a lot of things. Another particularly topical use of various data-related physics I want to go into is in the detection of gravitational waves by LIGO. I'm sure everybody is very familiar with this. Certainly most interesting experimental discovery in quite a long time. So what are we seeing here? So this just figure is just showing the the waveforms that were measured for the two different detectors. And you can see there's a very clear signal in here. So this is a case where, actually by eye, you can see there's a signal. So you know, you're not having to apply particularly advanced statistical techniques to see that this is there in this 0.1 second of data. The problem is that after you've been running for, you know, tens of days, how do you know exactly which is the 0.1 second that you want to be looking at? And so what you need to do is you need to be processing this data again in real time, pretty much. You don't, you know, the computational problem is sufficiently difficult, you don't want to get behind. And there's many different ways in which you can envisage some gravitational wave signal being generated by mergers of different objects, of different masses, different spin parameters. So there's some huge parameter space on which, you know, to define what was the individual event. The way this is basically done is you generate templates for some large and representative set of events, and then you are just real-time matching a filter against the incoming time stream. So you're searching the time stream in real time, and you're just projecting the signal onto these different events. And you're looking for things which are peaks in the likelihood, which is just saying I want to find something which is not particularly realizable by a noise fluctuation. And you're selecting things which exceed some kind of rate of false positives. So you want to, you know, find something which is just really not likely to be noise. And then the great thing about LIGO is you have two of these detectors, and you know, you should see the signal in both. So you have an extra check in that you're only going to keep events which are coincident in both detectors. And so they have to be seen within roughly the light travel time between the two detectors in order to be kept. Once you've actually identified the time at which the event happened, now you can actually do a much better job of this. So now you can look at a full kind of parameter estimation of what was going on in order to find the event. And so what you're doing here is you're having some parametric model of what happened. This is like the location on the sky, the masses of the progenitors that went into the collision. And you're basically doing some parameter estimation to infer what are the parameters of this particular event. And so you can do this as a kind of fairly standard Bayesian inverse problem, where you do some Markov chain Monte Carlo technique to infer the different parameters. And you end up with things like this. So what you're getting out is you're getting out samples from the probability distribution of the parameters themselves. And this is just showing projections of this probability distribution. So up here, you're seeing the masses of the two black holes which merged. And so you're getting, you know, nice distributions of the masses. Here you're seeing something which is quite useful. This is the location on the sky. So this is the degree to which the event was localized on the sky. And this you can, if you form quickly enough, you can use for pointing other telescopes at it. So if you thought you might see some electromagnetic counterpart, you can point telescopes quickly at this region, survey it, and see if you saw anything. And that allows you to really pin down the location. Now, having gone over this, I think there's a few sort of aspects of when you do these kind of inferences that in mind. There's a few different things. So you might consider doing these the various processes I've gone over, various aspects of data science, there's a few different places which they occur. One is kind of during the acquisition phase. And this is usually what's happening when you have some huge torrent of data and you need to get it down to some manageable size, you need to do that in real time. So you can't afford to get behind this kind of thing. There's a kind of post-acquisition phase where you're really just trying to get out, you know, basic results. You're trying to find, look at power spectra, summary statistics of your data. You're trying to find a likelihood function which describes the data. So you're really trying to pinch it together. And then there's the kind of final science aspect, which is where you're like really trying to, you're taking everything you know about this, you're now trying to figure out, usefully scientific things, like what was the parameters that went into this? What is the theory that governs this kind of thing? And, at this point, you can synthesize with other data sets, and there's a huge sort of selection of the kind of usual cross-correlation, model selection, parameter estimation, things in there. Now, I just want to shift gears slightly, and start talking about the work that I do in the field that I work in. So I work in cosmology, particularly using radio in order to probe things like dark energy. And I just want to start introducing that. And we're going to see that these phases come up in that kind of work. So just want to start briefly with just introducing the area. So about, 20 years ago, I guess now, the first sort of concrete evidence appeared that the universe was accelerating. Now, this comes from using type 1a supernova. So type 1a supernova is a standard, or at least standardizable, candle, where it's a supernova that goes off, and you can know its intrinsic luminosity via some process. Now, the use of this is if you have observed the event on Earth, you know its flux, and then you can compare that to the intrinsic luminosity, and you can put a distance to that supernova. Now, if you've also followed up with a spectrograph, you've got a redshift to that supernova, and so you can place points in a distance redshift plane. So this is the kind of modern analog of the kind of classic Hubble diagram of recession velocity and distance. And the shape of this curve is basically governed by the expansion history of the universe. And so by measuring this curve, you can infer how the universe is expanding. Now, this inset here has just taken this data. It has re-binned it all into a smaller number of points so you can see things more clearly. And it's just referenced it to a particular model, which is what we think the universe is now. Now, this line down here was the kind of favored cosmological model, 20, 30 years ago, which is an Einstein de Sitter universe, which decelerates. But you find that the supernova lie up here, which is telling you that the universe is accelerating. So the interesting question is, and probably the biggest question in contemporary cosmology, is what is driving this acceleration? So what is the thing that's causing this to happen? Now, you can say the acceleration is basically explained by dark energy, where dark energy is a substance invented to explain the acceleration. So leaving aside the kind of tautology there, the various things you might think that there's various models which you might use to explain acceleration. Things like a cosmological constant, so something fundamental about the vacuum just causing this. Or quintessence, where you have some fundamental scalar field, which we haven't seen, but is causing this acceleration. They can be probed by looking at the expansion history. So the expansion history is basically governed by the Friedman equation. And so this is how the universe is expanding in the Hubble parameter. This term here, basically what comes from dark energy. And the fundamental physics is really contained in this last part here, in this term here, which is the equation of state. The equation of state is really just telling you how the pressure is related to the density of the medium. And for an acceleration, it has to be less than minus one-third at any time. And so what we want to do is we want to be able to take data about the universe, and we want to be able to infer things about this, which is going to tell us about fundamental physics. The general scheme by which you do that is you take your data, you construct some likelihood function for it, which is just describing the compatibility of an expansion history with that data. And then you use something like a Markov chain Monte Carlo method to infer the distribution of the parameters you care about given that data set. And so the general scheme is you pick some parameterization for the model you care about. So something standard would be that a is a kind of constant term for this equation of state and a first derivative. And other properties that you need in the expansion history, like just the amount of matter in the universe. You take, propose some set of those parameters, you generate an expansion history, you compare that to the data, and then you kind of loop over this. And you do this in such a way that the samples that you accept from this process are basically samples from the probability distribution of those parameters. And you can kind of plot those samples, and this is just essentially plotting the probability distribution of the data. And for the supernova, it gives you constraints like this. So it's telling you that these particular set of parameters lie in this plane. What you can see on here is this has been combined with other data sets. It's been combined with the cosmic microwave background, which has given you a region of parameter space which is now much more tightly constrained. And this is about the standard the values we understand the universe has. So equation of state of roughly minus one and matter density about 0.25. There's one set of constraints on here from Baryon acoustic oscillations, which I want to talk about. So you can see from this the use of combining different probes in here and how different probes allows you to pin down the parameters better because you can get rid of degeneracies. You can fix all these degeneracies. Now, one particular useful probe is Baryon acoustic oscillations. So Baryon acoustic oscillations are basically the remnants of sound waves that were propagating in the early universe. So for the first part of the universe's life after the Big Bang, it's just basically hot plasma, and the sound waves propagating around in this plasma. When the plasma cools enough, the baryons in it recombine to hydrogen, and the universe becomes neutral at that point, and the sound speed in this medium drops to zero. And so you had all these sound waves which are propagating around at nearly the speed of light, and then poof, the sound speed drops to zero and they get frozen in. So this leaves an imprint in the radiation and the matter in the universe. The imprint in the distribution of radiation is basically the famous peaks that you see in the power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. So probably everyone's familiar with these. These are the remnants of these acoustic oscillations. There is a weaker imprint left in the matter distribution, which can be seen at low redshift. And what we're going to do is use this as a kind of standard statistical ruler to probe the expansion history of the universe. Now, the way that this works is that the CMB is basically sufficiently well understood that the physical scale of that these sound waves could propagate to, the sound horizon, is well known. So it's known to be about 100 megaparsecs over h in size, where the dominant uncertainty in that statement is me not knowing exactly what the scale is. So it's pretty precisely known. Now, what you can do is you go out and you have something like a galaxy redshift survey, where you're surveying the three-dimensional structure of matter in the universe. And so you have something like, each of these points is a galaxy in the universe. You can see there's this kind of cosmic web structure. And what you're going to look at is clustering statistics in there. So you're going to look at how the different galaxies cluster, things like that, correlation function. When you look at the correlation function, you see that you have a feature in it, this little bump here. And this bump is this Baryon acoustic signal. So it's just this extra enhanced correlation on these scales. Now, we actually haven't, when we've done this measurement, we actually, we don't measure physical scales, we measure angles, we measure redshifts. And so we can use the fact that we know what the actual physical scale is from the CMB and what the apparent angular and scale is and the apparent size in redshift is to infer quantities like the angular diameter distance and the Hubble parameter at that particular redshift. So what we can do is we can use those in some in some way. So there's this quantity called the volume distance, which is just a synthesis of the angular diameter distance and the Hubble parameter. And it essentially allows us to construct similar distance redshift plots. So this is another version of the kind of Hubble diagram, this time made with baryon acoustic oscillations. Each of these points in here, this is existing data, is a current, a previous survey of large-scale structure. This is basically the redshift that the survey was at, and this is the distance that it placed to that survey. And you can see that, you know, the standard kind of cosmological model basically it gives this kind of line which fits those points pretty well. So by tightening down, by placing points in this plane and like really clamping down the errors, we can sort of pin down the expansion history of the universe in the same way we did with the supernova. Now, you can see that this kind of runs out around redshift 1, or a bit less than 1. The reason is that it's difficult to do the galaxy redshift surveys beyond that redshift, just because it's more challenging to take spectra there. And so it is challenging to do this in the optical, but there's potential to do this in the radio. And it would be nice to push to higher redshifts, because this gives a bigger handle on the expansion. Now, the way I want to describe doing that is with a 21-centimeter intensity mapping. Now, to get everyone on the same page, I'm sure everyone knows this, but the 21-centimeter line that is the thing we're really interested in is just the transition from in neutral hydrogen for the spins of the proton and the electron being parallel to them being antiparallel. So the antiparallel state has a very slightly lower energy. When you transition from one to the other, you emit a photon of wavelength 21 centimeters, so a very low energy photon. That photon is in the radio. It's wavelength 21 centimeters, obviously. And so this gives you a way of seeing neutral hydrogen out in the universe. Now, the physics of how this emission works is kind of complicated. Basically, the ratio between the two states is governed by a quantity called the spin temperature, or that at least defines the spin temperature. For most of the universe that we care about, that is equivalent to the gas temperature, which is hot. So the gas is hot. What we see really is we see the contrast of this quantity to the cosmic microwave background. So if the spin temperature happened to be colder than the cosmic microwave background, you would absorb photons out of the CMB, and at that wavelength you would see a decrement in the brightness you would expect. If the spin temperature is hotter than the CMB, you see an emission of photons on top of what you'd expect, and so you see more photons. And that's the limit we're really in. Now, in the universe, where is the hydrogen? So at very high redshift, everything was, before recombination, there was just a plasma, so there wasn't really any neutral hydrogen. We have a long swathe of the universe where there's a lot of neutral hydrogen and no luminous sources. It's called the Dark Ages, where really the only thing you could basically see is this 21-centimeter emission. At some point, you start not only luminous sources, but ionizing sources. And so these are generating photons which can ionize the neutral hydrogen. And they eat away at the neutral hydrogen around themselves. And so you have these kind of expanding ionized bubbles. And these bubbles expand until they've essentially covered the whole universe, and almost all the hydrogen in the universe has been ionized. Except at low redshift in high density regions, so in galaxies, you can get clumps of neutral hydrogen, which were sufficiently dense that they could self-shield against the ionizing background. So they're sufficiently dense that the recombination rate is just fast enough that they don't really ionize. And so at very low redshift, you see neutral hydrogen in galaxies. This gives you a way of basically doing something like a galaxy redshift survey. So, what you might envisage doing is just doing the exact analog of an optical galaxy redshift survey. And so, just worth thinking about what you do in that kind of survey first. So, what you do is you look out on the sky, you make images of the sky, and you find galaxies in there. And you do this, you're finding these individual galaxies with very high significance, because you want to know it's an actual galaxy. Then you take a spectrograph and you take a spectrum of each of the galaxies. Now, you integrate for a long time, basically, to find the redshift of the galaxy. And this is just because you needed the three-dimensional position. So you'd already found the two-dimensional position, but you want to know how far away the galaxy is. But in the end, you don't care about things on galactic scales. You only really care about the very large scales for these kind of measurements. And so it's kind of strange that you, in order to do this experiment, you had to measure the really fine scales to do this. So there's an idea. Before I go on, the original thoughts about how you would do these 21 centimeter surveys would be you'd do the exact analogs. You'd find individual galaxies in their 21 centimeter mission. It turns out there's a better way of doing this. And what you do is you observe the universe with a line transition. So you'll say, OK, I know I'm going to look at some specific line. And so if I'm looking at 21 centimeters, the 21 centimeter line, if I'm observing at 42 centimeters, that means I'm looking at stuff at redshift 1. And so you automatically got the radial coordinate from this. Having done that, you actually find you don't need to see the individual galaxies anymore. You can build a low-resolution instrument which doesn't resolve any individual galaxies. It just looks at the unresolved emission. For the 21 centimeter, you're just getting the redshift from the frequency you're observing at, and you're observing the diffuse emission from many unresolved galaxies. And this just means that you can build a very different sort of instrument, and a much cheaper instrument to do this experiment than you thought you might be able to do in the past. So there's a caveat to doing this, and that is the statement that when you're looking at a certain wavelength, you're looking at the emission from the 21 centimeter. So just to illustrate that in a couple of slides, this is just a very quick simulation I made of what the 21 centimeter signal would look like. There's going to be a few of these kind of plots. It's just worth explaining exactly what they are. This is the celestial sphere at some particular frequency. So this is just what your telescope would map at some frequency. This is the square plot over here is a cut at some particular angle here. So it's just a line along there. And then it's going back in frequency. So it's showing you multiple frequencies. One thing to note is that, which you probably can't see very well from the back, is the amplitude of this signal is about a millikelvin in size. So it's it's about a millikelvin in size. However, there are other things which shine on the sky at these kind of frequencies, the big one being our own galaxy. Our own galaxy shines up to about 700 Kelvin, so it's extremely bright in comparison. And so the signal you're interested in is buried by factors of hundreds of thousands from beneath the foregrounds. And so one way you can consider getting around this is that you might have noticed is that the 21 centimeter signal, every frequency is looking at a different slice of the universe. And so these are mostly uncorrelated if you go far enough apart. Our galaxy, however, it's all generated by synchrotron. In fact, almost all the foregrounds are generated by synchrotron. It's spectrally extremely smooth. And so if you know what's going on in this frequency slice, you can predict what this frequency slice is to some extremely high degree. And so a scheme you might do to get rid of the foreground is just to remove spectrally smooth modes. Now, again, there's a caveat to doing this, a problem called mode mixing. When I started doing getting into this 21 centimeter game, it came as a surprise to me that the beams of telescopes, so the response which they surveyed the sky, were not Gaussians and were not frequency independent. They turned out to have a lot of complicated structure. And this can be very problematic. So this is just a cartoon. So this is what we've got on the sky is just one point source. So just one very bright source, which is spectrally smooth.
You weren't surprised that the beams are frequency independent, but
no, I wasn't surprised by that. It's just, well, I'll never tell that joke again. So there's just a single point source on the sky, and we have some instrumental beam with side lobes. And as you go from low frequency to mid frequency to high frequency, this thing gets smaller in the standard kind of optical scaling. If the point source is completely on axis, you would just see the intensity as a function of frequency would just be some smooth line, just giving you the intensity of the point source back. If the point source is slightly off axis, then you have a a bit of a problem. So what happens is, at low frequencies, you've started at the maximum of one side lobe. At mid frequencies, you're now in between two side lobes. And at high frequencies, you're at the maximum of another side lobe, in this example. And so the intensity you would observe has this kind of wiggle in it now. And so even though the point source itself is spectrally very smooth. And so what's going on here is that the frequency dependence and the shape of your beam is mixing the angular structure on the sky, so the fact there's only one point source, into the observed spectral structure, even though the actual spectral structure was smooth. And so this means that any naive scheme by which you might try and get rid of this emission is difficult to do. So you can't just look only at spectral modes. You need to combine angular modes in order to undo this problem. Now this problem is an issue. There's been a little bit of progress made observing this 21 centimeter emission. I'm going to skip through this a little bit. Basically, using cross correlations to get around this foreground problem, people have managed to observe the 21 centimeter emission. So we know there's a signal out there to find. We know roughly what its amplitude is. This was done with this telescope here. It's the Greenbank telescope. It's the world's biggest steerable telescope. It only has one pixel as a problem, so it's very slow to do these kind of measurements. And so to survey the whole sky to a reasonable depth takes like roughly 20 years to do. So there are ways of getting around this and surveying the sky much faster. That's using interferometers. And so the project I mostly work on, it's a project called CHIME, which some of you may have heard of. CHIME is a Canadian project. It's a collaboration between four institutes and a number of individuals at other institutes, most notably Kendrick here. It looks very different to a lot of radio interferometers you might be used to. So rather than looking like a kind of standard radio telescope, it consists of four half pipes. So this is the kind of full instrument which has sort of been built, although not instrumented. So schematically, it looks a bit like this. To note what's going on, these cylinders only focus in one direction. So they focus in the east-west direction. They don't do anything in the north-south direction. They just reflect. So if you think about what a single, you just put an antenna on here and said, OK, what kind of shape beam does that have? It is about 2 degrees wide, but it sees basically horizon to horizon because it doesn't focus in that direction. So just left like that, you'd have no angular resolution, and this instrument would be useless. So what do you do to get angular resolution? Well, what you do is you put many feeds up on that focal line, and you look at the correlations between them. And so this is an interferometer. So with interferometer, the thing you are measuring, the key quantity you're measuring is called visibility. It's the correlation between any two antennas. And each pair is basically measuring a Fourier mode of the sky. And that Fourier mode is basically is governed by the separation of these antennas in wavelengths. So what you do is you take something like CHIME, which has all these antennas along the focal line of each cylinder. You cross-correlate different pairs of them. You take all these measurements, and you put them all together, and you use that to give yourself angular resolution along this beam. So you can break this beam up into individual, sorry, you can break this giant beam up into individual synthesized beams that you can see and get angular resolution in. A few other pertinent details of CHIME. CHIME observes between 400 and 800 megahertz, which corresponds to being between about redshift 0.8 and redshift 2.5 for the 21 centimeter emission. So this is looking at a region of the universe which is not well covered by existing instruments. The instrument is mostly, we have a prototype instrument which is generating data. This is just showing vaguely some data which we've taken late last year. This is just several consecutive days. One of the dominant things you can see in here is the sun. So this horseshoe is the sun up during the daytime. If you look carefully, you can see that it moves. So if you look from here to here, you can see it's moved. So that's a good sign. This band here is our galaxy. So you can see our galaxy in here. You can see that doesn't move, which is also a good sign. I just want to briefly talk about things like, with Chime, the data rate. So with Chime, you have like you actually have basically 2,000 different antennas on there, and you're going to do the pairwise correlations of all of them. That generates a huge amount of data. So for the full correlation, it's about 5 gigabytes per second, so which ends up just being an inordinately large amount of data per year. This is just way more than we could really handle. So we need a way to significantly compress this data down. Chime, it turns out, is an highly redundant array. So because there's a regular spacing, there are many different pairs which have exactly the same separation. So this one has the same separation as this one, which has the same separation as this one, and the same separation as this one, and so on. So what we can do is if we group these equivalent baselines together, we can significantly compress the data. So we can get down from 5 gigabytes a second to about 5 megabytes per second. This is just a much more civilized amount of data to deal with. Unfortunately, our ability to do this is broken by things that break this degeneracy between the different feed pairs. So each feed, so I guess each one of these on its own has a gain associated with it, which is unknown. So you can have the amplifiers vary with how much amplification they do. The cable length varies, so there's different delays along each cable which give different phases. So there's an unknown complex number per frequency per time associated with each of these. And so if these vary enough, when you average over these different pairs, the averaging ends up being incoherent and you get rid of your signal if you do this naively. So what you need to do is you need to be able to calibrate the instrument. And because you need to do this compression in real time, because you've got so much data, you need to be able to calibrate the instrument in real time. I don't want to dwell too much on this problem. We have some schemes for dealing with this, which basically involve injecting specific signals for calibration and then trying to solve the system in some nearly optimal way in real time, and then correcting for the gains and then averaging over the data. So this is just a kind of real-time process you need to be able to deal with in Chime in order to just get the data rate down to something you can handle.
How much does the calibration fluctuate over time? I mean, to what extent can you calibrate once and then use that versus recalibrating sort of continuously?
The bulk of the time-dependent gain fluctuations are common between all the antennas. So because the things are just like cables varying in length ever so slightly, by like millimeters as the temperature changes, that causes phase differences between them. A lot of that expansion is common because the cables are nearly all the same length. However, this huge range between the foregrounds and the signal, this factor of 10 to the 5, means that you need to be able to calibrate instantaneously to about a factor of 0.01%. And so although the bulk of this is common, like in reality you need to be able to solve instantaneously to really high precision to make sure you've captured that 0.1% fluctuation.
Are you trying to model the foreground or remove point sources, or is it all in the data processing format?
I am going to come onto that a little bit. To finish up with, I want to discuss really the work that I've been doing with this. And this is looking at how you're going to take this kind of sort of post-acquisition data and how you're going to turn it into scientific observables you care about. So things like maps of the sky, power spectrum, things like that. So one thing I want to just explain is basically how this method we develop works. So I flashed this up briefly, but I didn't really explain it, and I'm barely going to explain it now. But this is the fundamental quantity in interferometry is a visibility. So it's the correlation between two feeds I and J, and that's just some time stream that we've measured. At any instant, basically what it does is you have the sky, so that just the temperature on the sky. Each feed has some kind of beam, so it's just own response to the sky. And that's just some weighting across the sky. And then you have the phase factor between the two. So you have this geometric time delay or this Fourier mode which comes in between the two. And so this visibility is measuring a Fourier mode of basically of this kind of, is basically measuring a Fourier mode in this direction, which is the separation between the two feed pairs. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to just get rid of all the interferometry in this now. And so what you're going to do is you just take all of this stuff and you combine it into one function, which is just saying for this measured quantity, how does that measured quantity respond to the sky? So what is the response function to the sky? So I have some beam transfer function, we're going to call it, which just looks like something like this. So this is just a particular typical baseline. So you take the temperature of the sky, you multiply it by this function, you just integrate over the sky. And that's exactly what you get out. Now, having done that, all the interferometry, all the information about your telescope is in this quantity. But we can ignore basically what, for the most part, what that specifically is. Now, for the kind of telescopes we're interested in, things like CHIME, we're looking at transit telescopes. So this is a telescope where basically the telescope itself doesn't move. There's no moving part. It can't point or anything like that. What happens is you just fix it on the Earth, and the Earth rotates and does the pointing for you. And so because the Earth is just doing a rotation, it means the time stream itself is periodic on a sidereal day. So when the Earth's done one rotation, you should be measuring the same signal as you were measuring before. So the kind of analysis we do basically takes this restriction. So it maps time to the kind of angle of Earth rotation, and it just runs with that and sees how far you can get. So what we're going to do is we're just going to apply this restriction. We're going to replace time with azimuth angle. Basically, we're going to realize we're working on the sphere, so a very sensible thing to do is usually you should do the spherical harmonic transform. So we're just going to get in terms of harmonic modes on the sphere. We're going to do that for both the transfer function and for the sky. And then I think this function is periodic, so a very sensible thing you might consider doing with a periodic function is to take its Fourier transform. So you're going to decompose the time stream into Fourier modes. Now, once you've gone through all of that, what you're finding is you get this equation. Now, this is just mapping the spherical harmonics on the sky to the Fourier modes of the time stream for this particular feed pair. There's a few notable things about this. I've just having rewritten here. So this alpha is just refers to a specific feed pair. What is that? The m's on here are all the same. So this the m which describes the azimuthal mode for the spherical harmonics and for the beam transfer function map directly into the m that is the Fourier mode of the time stream. And so there's no mixing between these things. So provided your noise is stationary, so there's no statistical difference between any particular time on the sky as far as the noise is concerned, the measurement never mixes these m's at all. And so these m's remain statistically independent for the whole, for all your observation. That's going to have some nice properties. So a few of the things about this. If you just look at it in this form, it's just a very simple linear expression. So you have some vector of ALMs on the sky that maps into some vector of measurements you've made. There is a matrix B which is maps between the two. Now, running in this form, it just looks very much like it's just a standard linear measurement problem. And so you can apply all the kind of standard statistical processing stuff that you're used to this. It's much simpler than all the kind of crazy integral expressions you have for interferometry most of the time. The one useful thing I'm going to come back to is this independence of the different M's means that if you want to do some operation on your data, so say you want to consider the correlations of all the data that you've measured, so some correlation function of all these visibilities. Now, if you just put them all together naively, you'd have some huge matrix. But as the m's remain independent, it turns out to be block diagonal in the m index themselves. So say I want to diagonalize this covariance matrix, which is something you might want to do, it's going to turn out. If I have roughly 1,000 M's, which is about what I'm dealing with, rather than doing one huge diagonalization, I can break it up into 1,000 smaller diagonalizations. Because of the scaling of something like an eigenvalue operation, that saves you a factor of 1,000,000 in computation, being able to do that, and saves you a factor of 1,000 in storage. So this means that you can do a lot of things in a much more computationally efficient way than you thought were going to be possible. And it opens up a lot of avenues for how you're actually going to process your data in a much more optimal way than you thought you could do. So just a few examples of this. The kind of traditional interferometric imaging was really just based around the fact that the mapping from the sky to your measurements looks a lot like a Fourier transform. And so what you might naively do to make an image is just transform that back, and it turns out incompleteness in your measurements means you've got to do some fancy things. Also the fact that you've got a, if you have a measurement of a large part of the sky is no longer flat, so you have to get around that. The fact that the Earth rotates means that you're kind of measuring in different planes all the time, and you're measuring in different pointings, so you've got to get around that. And so there's decades of literature in radio astronomy trying to get around these kind of problems. And they turn out to be quite complex. So although it was superficially simple, you have to do kind of iterative deconvolutions of all your measurements. And it turns out to be nasty, and I don't pretend to understand any of it. However, for our problem with these transit telescopes, and it's clear, it needs to be clear that this only really works for these transit telescopes, the problem can be solved exactly. And so because your measurement is just this linear mapping for each of these M's, how do you make an image of the sky? Well, the sky is just this A. So this vector A contains all the information about the sky. Your measurements is this vector V. And you know this matrix B. This is just describing your array. So how do you make an image? Well, what you do is you just use all the kind of standard techniques of statistical processing, and you use some kind of inverse, some sort of pseudo-inverse, or some Wiener filter or something to basically make some statistical inversion of your measurements V in order to infer what A is. So this is conceptually very straightforward. I think all the information about your telescope is just in this matrix, which you can just put in there, and then it will deal with it all for you. Unlike a lot of the traditional stuff, it deals exactly and very naturally with all the full sky effects. It deals with polarization precisely. I didn't really include polarization when I was describing before, but it all works fine. If you just do this on simulated data, so this is a simulated map of the foreground, a simulated map of the 21 centimeter. And I make a synthetic time stream from this, and then just apply this map making operation, so this imaging to it, you get something back like this. So it makes a pretty good reproduction of the sky. You're missing this part because I put the telescope at a latitude of 45 degrees, so you didn't see the southern polar cap. Another application of this optimality, and, well, this computational efficiency, I guess, but something you can do a little more optimal is foreground removal. So this is the big problem for 21 centimeter stuff. Now, as I mentioned, the spectral smoothness is what allows you to separate these two things, but doing it in reality turns out to be more challenging because of these problems like mode mixing. There's a few other properties you would like from your foreground removal method. One is it should be robust. It should be robust to you really not knowing what the foregrounds are very well. Also, you would like to understand what it's doing very well. So you're doing some processing on your data, and in order to do other stages kind of optimally, you need to know exactly what you threw away. And so it's good to understand exactly what that is. Another issue I don't really have time to go into, but although the foregrounds are spectrally smooth in total intensity, in the polarization, they have a very large amount of spectral structure. And so you need to be able to reject polarized information on the sky to a very precise degree in order to not have the same problem. We have been trying to do the foreground removal with what's a fairly old idea. It's been used in the for CMB analysis for a long time, particularly for E and B mode separation, and it was basically used in the BICEP results where they measured the B modes of dust very well. Now, basically, this is a way of separating out two signals where you think you know the two-point statistics of them. And so what you're going to do is you use a model for what you think the sky looks like in for the signal and for the foreground separately. And you use this to generate a set of modes which are ordered from the amount of the interesting 21 centimeter signal they have in them to the amount of foreground power they have in them. And so you get a statistically uncorrelated set of modes where they are just described by the amount of signal power to foreground power. And so you can use this as a kind of classifier. So you, if you put your data in the same basis, you can use this to say, okay, I know, given this model, I think these modes are signal dominated and these modes are foreground dominated. And I'm just going to use this to throw away the foreground dominated modes. If you look at what some of these modes look like on the sky, they look vaguely like you would expect. This one is the most foreground looking mode. So you can see that it's very smooth in the spectral direction. This is the most signal-like mode. You can see in this direction that it's oscillating in frequency, so it has a lot of spectral structure. In between, it's actually extremely difficult to predict what these modes would look like. So you could guess something that this is what they'd look like, but in the middle, it's very difficult to do. So it's good to have a kind of automated procedure which is telling you how to choose these particular modes. Basically mentioned it. The process for foreground filtering is really you construct these models of the sky. They are statistical models. They only really need to encode the smoothness of the sky. So it's the only real input in them is that they should have spectral smoothness. And the projection into the basis of your data really takes care of the rest. And all you do is you just throw away modes which you think are too foreground contaminated. What this looks like in practice, again, just going through and showing you what happens if you simulate various components in the sky. So these two are foreground simulations. This is a kind of unpolarized foreground simulation. This is the polarized part, which I don't really want to talk about, and this is the 21 centimeter part. Again, it's the same factor of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 between the two. If I make synthetic time streams from all these components individually, and then I apply the foreground filter to them, you get this out. So what you can see is, if you could really read the amplitudes off from the back, that the amplitude of the foreground components has been reduced significantly below the amplitude of the signal now. And if you look at this plot, I think it's the clearest, when I sort of flick back and forth, you can hopefully see that the structure in the two kind of stays pretty similar. So there's definite correlation in the structure between the two. So this is good because the best foreground filter you can envisage just multiplies your data by zero and gets rid of the signal as well. So you're looking for something which is about the second best foreground filter you can envisage. Another way of looking at this is in the two-dimensional power spectrum. So you're just looking at, the two-dimensional power spectrum is the quantity you're really interested in for baryon acoustic oscillations. This is just showing your ability to constrain power in modes along the line of sight. So this is the fluctuations along the line of sight. This is fluctuations transverse to the line of sight. In a case that there were no foregrounds on the sky that you had to filter out, and in a case that you have the full complement of foregrounds, you've gone through all the foreground filtering. When you've used this foreground filter, you find that the dominant thing that you've lost is an ability to constrain modes down here. So this means you can't constrain things which are smooth along the line of sight, which is the modes you thought were contaminated anyway. And so you basically got down to the level you'd expect. This is different to some of the other claims earlier in the literature, which I won't really particularly go into. Anyway, to finish up, just want to briefly summarize what I've talked about. So sort of started out talking about data science and how that maps how that's becoming an increasingly important part of physics. across a broad spectrum of disciplines. The same is definitely true for cosmology and astronomy. It's been there for a long time, although we've been calling it statistics for most of that time. With experiments like CHIM, you have the same challenges. So the data volume is challenging, the foregrounds are challenging, and this requires you to look at new ways of analyzing your data, thinking a little bit more differently to kind of traditional routes in order to try and get around these problems. And that was what I sort of talked about at the end with our new technique for doing that. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Questions for Do you have any indication from the Pathfinder data how well you will be able to subtract the foreground?
I would like to say yes, but no. So it turns out, much to my surprise again, that dealing with a real instrument is not like dealing with simulated data, and there's a lot of things in there that we don't actually understand yet. We're getting there. So there's aspects that are not perfect, which are fixed on the full instrument, like the quality of the mesh surface. That affects the shapes of the individual beams of the feeds. And that turns out to be an important ingredient you need to know in order to do the analysis I've been discussing. So we're currently sort of...
Because it comes into the beam profile.
Yeah, so it turns out the aspects of this look... that you need to do to get rid of this mode mixing problem, you're doing something which is essentially deconvolving in the time direction to get back to the sky. And that's quite sensitive to your knowledge of what the individual primary beams are. And we're trying to learn about that at the moment.
It's quite hard to calibrate because you can't point
it out. It is hard to calibrate. So we have a few ways of doing that. The mundane of just looking at point sources going through and allowing that to give you the
Could you plane over it?
Yeah, so that's the sexy way of doing it. So drones are all the rage at the moment. So what you do is you just put a radio source on a drone and you just follow it through. And you turns out you have to do some very fancy stuff to make that work.
But you're gonna do that.
We're going to do that. I think the more realistic option for what we're doing is looking at pulsars. So the problem with a normal radio point source is other things on the sky. And so you're not quite sure what's something else on the sky that's causing you to see this thing in your beam and what was the actual beam itself. So the thing about a pulsar is because it flashes on and off. You take the time it's on, you subtract the time it's off, and then you get only the pulsar back. So you've removed the rest of the sky. And this gives a perfect point source. You watch drift through the beam, and you can get profiles through the beam very well that way, is the theory. People have done that on other telescopes. So we've done a little bit of it at CHIME. I've done a little bit of it on a GMRT telescope in India, and people have done it elsewhere.
So far, it's instrumental problems that have...
It's instrumental problems, but we're trying to get on top of those.
Yep.
I was curious, because here's a CHIME question I don't know the answer to. What fancy stuff do you have to do to make the drone calibration work?
What you really want to know about is not just the amplitude that your beam has in a particular direction, but the phase it has in a particular direction. So you want to know how much a signal is really delayed when it comes in from a direction it goes through the antenna and the reflection and everything. If you just have a drone going over and it's broadcasting a signal out, which is sort of constant in power, you can know what its amplitude was in that direction, but you can't know the phase. So you can't know how long the signal took to get there. So what we do with the pulsars...
Well, when you can do whatever you want with it, whatever signal you want.
Right, so that's the key thing. So one thing you can do is you generate a time stream which you know.
Yeah.
And you're rather than just generating random noise, you're generating a pseudo-random sequence which you know. And then you can feed that directly into the correlator and correlate against it. And that gives you the time delay information. the way you get around that with things like a pulsar is you track with a specific telescope, and that is the correlation between the tracking telescope and the transit telescope that tells you the time delay. But you can't do that with a drone because it's just never, it's never far enough away, basically.
And you're observing the whole sky?
Yes, I didn't really talk about it. You see about 2/3 of the sky.
So you have a huge number of pointers there. So why would you think about the drone and compared to all the lots of point sources?
So there's not that many bright point sources is the problem. So you have, so if you're just looking at a kind of standard radio galaxy point source, that is not that useful for calibration, because if it's not that bright, you're not guaranteed that that's the only thing in your beam. And so it doesn't look like a point source anymore. There's all sorts of other things going on. You have to do a lot of modeling for everything in your beam to really understand what the beam profile is. For the pulsars getting around that, there are a lot of pulsars on the sky. Again, you get down to the level that they're getting kind of dim. There's a real anisotropy in known pulsars in where they are in the sky. So people are focused on particular regions of the sky, and there's huge blank patches, which we would need to know the beam for, but there's no real known bright pulsars there. And so to do that, we'll have to be discovering pulsars at the same time.
But a drone will also, you wanted to cover the whole sky with a drone, will also be difficult.
Yeah, again, it's pretty difficult, but it's a little more controllable. You can pick where it goes.
A lower tech. The ultimate thing to do, I agree, would be to have actually have a pseudo random electric field coming out of the drone.
Yeah,
but you can also just broadcast noise, but put it on some sort of clock that shuts on and off at a relatively coarse time resolution, just to make the drone the same block on the pulse.
But I think so what you'd have to do, the thing you need is you need something which is always measuring the drone at the same time, with always the same time delay. So what you have with pulsar, you track and chime the 26 meter telescope, and that always has the same time delay to the pulsar. And then when you correlate the 26 meter against the chime feed, you're measuring the time delay on chime relative to some specific direction, and that you don't get from the drone, even if you're blinking it, unless you're also tracking it with some telescope.
So what is the schedule of chimes if everything goes well?
I showed some, I guess it's from late last year. There's a picture in there showing you the four cylinders. The four cylinders, the physical structure is built, so the steelwork's all done. Which is a big milestone. What they don't have is any instrumentation on them yet. So we have a Pathfinder instrument, which is about half scale. So it's two cylinders about half length, which we're doing everything with now. The idea is to finish building all the instrumentation over the next few months and to start deploying it on the instrument over the summer and towards the end of the year. And then hopefully we'll have the correlator installed on similar timescales and get everything hooked up and start having data at some point next year. But the commissioning might take a while.
Same question again for
Thanks.